When Chinese President Xi Jinping came to power in 2014, he coined the phrase new normal, a phrase he brought about to bring more balanced economic growth and a cleaner bureaucracy, it was said. The phrase entered the vocabulary of all organisations, including housing and urban development. So, in place of a free-for-all, which one might say had existed in urban development, restrictions have developed regarding what levels and through what departments urbanisation can be undertaken. My next guest, Professor Peter Rowe, knows all about the new normal. He's Professor of Architecture and Urban Design at Harvard University, and he joins me on the line from New York. Professor Rowe, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you.
Can you explain the new normal for us, but can you also give us some information on the mind-boggling development that's happening in China?
Well, the new normal is pretty much as you said in your preamble. The stress now shifts from quantity and, you know, pursuit of GDP at all costs to quality in the various sectors of operation in China. And it comes at a time in which they want the urban development to occur in a probably a more regular and manageable way. And they're not seeking to create these mega cities all over the place anymore, but rather to have a much more balanced form of urban settlement from very large cities to medium-sized ones and to small ones. And, you know, they're facing probably what will become a decline in population by around 2035. The population is aging, particularly under the auspices of the one-child, one-family policy that's been in place for a long time, which has just become altered recently. So they're sort of, I wouldn't say slowing things down exactly, but lifting their foot off the accelerator with respect to this pursuit of economic growth at all costs. And I think that's a good thing for them to have done, actually.
Yeah, sure.
The environmental footprint was getting too big. Citizens were beginning to object to all of that. A lot of the cities were not able to provide probably the level of service that they could before. So it makes a lot of sense. Going to the mind-boggling growth, I mean, sure, they managed to house, in urban circumstances, about 130 million people, which is not exactly small.
No, it's huge. 100 new airports, I understand, 100 new airports. We argue decades about one.
Yes, I know. 3,200 museums or art galleries and things of this sort. Massive diversification of uses in urban areas from the early days of the People's Republic anyway. Phenomenal. And, of course, the high-speed train system, which I use quite frequently when I go there, that really makes the time cost of travel very, very short, even from one big city to another.
Mm. So given that there was this huge expansion, which I won't say was uncontrolled, but if you look at it now, you might say it was. What are the parameters, the broad parameters that the Chinese are now trying to bring on future development?
Well, as I said, they're interested in orderly development. By the way, you hear the term a rapid rate of urban development. Sometimes that's not correct because, in fact, places like Beijing and Shanghai have been expanding at about 3% per annum growth, which compared to, for example, growth of Seoul in Korea in the 1960s or even growth in Japan in a similar period of time, which was around anywhere up to 10% per annum, 3% is not all that great. It's large by, let's say, American standards. You know, we chug along at probably about 1 to 1.5% per annum in well-established cities. But the volume of expansion has been enormous, right? I mean, well, because the base is very high, 1.3 billion people.
Given this volume, have they in the past and are they now looking to create areas that have some sense of identity or community in neighbourhoods? I mean, you imagine with that kind of volume of development that it's very mass-produced and very, if you like, banal.
Yeah, it was very, very monotonic, I would say. Yes, true. Yes, they are. They're placing a lot more emphasis, particularly in some of the tier 2, 3, 4, 5 towns, on their kind of local characteristics and on their sort of competitive advantages They might have to do with the natural resources that are nearby, or the kind of cultural patrimony that's in place, or the natural setting that's around, and to use that as a way of giving a sense of identity to these places. They have active programs for doing that.
Yeah. So now we've got a situation, it is a question, where we're looking at clever designs for residential neighbourhoods, small urban areas on the edges of bigger cities, really sensibly planning. Is that right?
Well, I...
No, you're not sure about that.
I hope, yeah. I mean, it's not only on the edges either. I mean, you're sort of describing this as a sort of egg model, you know, with the yolk in the middle and the white stretching out on the edges.
Yeah.
No, that's not true either, really. I mean, there's a lot of redevelopment going on in some of the more established areas. One of the things that Xi Jinping's group have actually said, that they sort of regard the past 25 or 30 years as a first draft.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I find that to be an interesting term. It's sort of like, well, that was the first draft. Now we're really going to get down to writing the real thing, as it were. And
can I interrupt you there? Not meaning to be difficult, but that does strike me in one sense as being particularly Chinese and acceptable, because we're always looking to governments to come up with the solution, the magic bullet. This is it. This is as good as you're going to get. This is perfect. Whereas the Chinese, I think, have a longer term view that things will continue to evolve, and not to assess that what they've done now is perfect, to always be looking to the longer term, whereas we tend to look at building something, getting it finished, and it's done.
Well, I'm not sure about that, actually, as an American.
Okay. You think they're a bit short-term too, do you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They can be very short-term. In fact, one of the problems, I think, in the past has been that, a mayor sails in from somewhere else, because they usually aren't the homegrown boys, and they don't really know the place very well, and they decide, well, they look around for a pet project, and they go do it. And sometimes it's kind of not such a great idea, and it's done in a very short space of time. So I'm not sure I would say
that. Okay. What about the sponge cities?
That was a term that I think came from one of our graduates, a guy by the name of Kong Jung Yu. One of the problems in China vis-a-vis, well, its growth in general, is the fact that it's in a water-scarce country by and large, particularly if you rule a line from, say, Shanghai due west, and the area above it is quite water-scarce, and the area below it's got sort of ample water, so there's this whole building of channels and canals and so forth from south to north going on. And they have about 670-odd cities and about 230, I believe, or some fairly large number like that, don't have adequate water supplies. So retention and water harvesting is a big deal. And Sponge City is talking about that. It's sort of saying we should retain and water on site for the purposes of water harvesting. And also, a lot of these cities flood. And Sponge City is saying, well, one way to prevent floods is to absorb the water in a manner that allows it to mimic, shall we say, the natural process before urbanisation occurred, so that the flooding is mitigated. The problem I have with it is that if you know anything about hydrology and unit hydrographs and the way in which streams work...
No, I don't.
There are some places in which... Well, let me explain it to you. There are some places in a watershed that's travelling through an urban area... Some places where you should, during a severe storm events, detain water on site as much as possible. In other words, the Sponge City idea. There are other areas where you should get it away as quickly as you possibly can, which of course is the opposite. It's where you build, concrete channels and things of this sort. So, by and large, I think it's an attempt to try and mimic the natural process that's in place for dealing with storm events and dealing with rainfall and so on. But, unless it's sort of reasonably well calibrated, it can get also out of control.
Now, the urban communities in China, is it changing how they are structured in the sense that they presumably were territorially based in the past, put together because of political administration? It's through the administration to have this city controlled by these people doing this with that purpose, as opposed to, well, what would naturally evolve there, a more top-down arrangement of cities than them having some sort of common purpose that was obvious and developed organically, if you like. What can you tell us about the way communities are now structured?
Well, in the past, you're probably right. If you mean by territorial that they were sort of, the idea of community was highly spatial.
Yeah.
It's been that, it was that way and still is to some extent, or fairly strong extent, for, you know, since, let's say, the Shang Dynasty, which is around about, what, 1500 BC. And they went through various models of community that tended to relate to clans and families, and so many clans made up such and such an area, and that area was nested into another set of areas, and so it went on in order to move up towards what we would call a city or something close to that. So the spatial aspect of community has always been very, very strong in China, and really still is. I mean, in 2014, I did a lot of sort of survey work of communities in four or five cities in China, and most of them were fairly bounded, you might say. They had either fences around it, or they were what you might call gated communities, not entirely, but substantially, which provided a sort of sense of security for the people who lived inside it, and also allowed them to. They were pretty big too. Which allowed them to have their own kind of vegetated and other amenities inside of the community rather than outside of it. And this is a pattern that has been perpetuated for a long period of time. Now they're deciding, well, these big blocks are too big. We need to make them a bit smaller, and we need to make them more porous. In other words, we need to be able to move around a city in shall we say, a less obstructed way or less controlled way, which is making it more perhaps like we are used to urbanisation in the West. But on the other hand, you know, it's not as if it's not also directed by market forces. The real estate industry in China is fairly ferocious, actually.
Mm. When you read about people who've made large amounts of money, there seems to be a prevalence of property development in there.
Yes.
Now, they've got an ageing population, as you mention. How does that change, and are they planning for the changes that might be required by that?
Well, they're aware of it, put it this way. I mean, they've watched, for example, Japan very closely, where this has occurred certainly in the last 10 or 15 years. And they, to my knowledge, they haven't sort of come up with a plan yet, or plans, but they are aware of the situation, and consequently I'm sure that they will begin to try to shape from the top manners in which communities can be built that are, shall we say, intergenerational in a somewhat better way, as well as taking care of older people.
If there was something, Professor Rowe, that you wanted to convey about development in China at the moment, what would that be? You know, we have a group of students sitting around at a coffee shop with us, and they're looking up to you as the man that knows, and they say, what do we need to know about development in China? What would you say?
Well, the thing that surprised me in some of the work I've been doing is that, you know, the middle class, if you want to call it that, in China is beginning to live fairly well. The sizes of places they're living in are still fairly small, certainly by American standards, but they're much larger than they were in the time of the people who were living there's parents' time, for example, or the beginning of the People's Republic. A lot of the sort of standardization of things has gone away. The variety of developments, either in high-rise or mid-rise buildings, is very wide compared to where it was before.
Mm-hmm.
And the on-site amenity, that is to say, places where you can recreate, places where you can shop, community services and things like that, are numerous and rather diverse, making some of these places probably pretty good places to live, actually.
Mm. Well, that leads to my next question. With such an enormous volume of development going on, does that beg the question, what about the quality?
Well, it's improved substantially, I would say. It started off being pretty bad, and now it's got to a level where, by and large, it's, I wouldn't say okay entirely, but it's getting there. I mean, you know, if I was to be critical of Australia, where you are, right,
mm-hmm.
you have these big central cities and then you've got this monotonic array of suburban areas around
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
You really do have an egg, like
yeah.
the yellow stuff in the middle and the white stuff around the outside. So, you know, China's not really like that and it's getting a little more varied. So I would say that's a positive aspect.
Indeed. I did see some apartments in Guangzhou, I think a person who I was visiting had four blocks of apartments on the river in Guangzhou. I don't know how many stories, but very substantial. And the environmental aspects of those buildings was just phenomenal, down to the glass that would sort of change what light would come in at certain times of the day. I mean, these were not cheap and there was nothing shoddy about them. And that is a problem, I think, for perhaps Australians thinking about things in China. They tend to think, oh, it's so big, it must be cheap, whereas, you know, that is not the case.
No, in fact, the other metric that's interesting is that 43% or 45% thereabouts of all the housing's been built in the last 10 years. And that has been with a technology that's fairly evolved in various parts of the world, and the stuff that they're using in China, I can assure you, is as evolved as it is in anywhere else I've been.
Absolutely.
Mm. Yeah, so if you can imagine. So I'm not surprised that the apartments you were visiting were pretty, shall we say, well-built and high-tech.
Absolutely, they were, absolutely. Do you agree with the proposition that a property developer in China put to me? He said he put it to Bill Clinton, which might have been a bit of name-dropping, I'm not sure, but we were talking about the way the West loosely thinks it can go and advise other countries on what they ought to do, as if the West somehow has some magic formula worked out that on everything. It's a bit up ourselves, really. And he said that he said to Bill Clinton, look, if I could make you speak Mandarin perfectly tomorrow, just by magic, I don't think you could run China. But if I could make Xi Jinping speak English perfectly, he could without doubt run America. What do you think of that?
I'm not sure what to say about that.
Okay, well, that might be a good point, Peter, to leave you with that to reflect on.
I'm not going to reflect on it. We have a president who I think is probably fairly close to Xi Jinping at the moment in lots of ways, okay?
Yeah, sure, I get it.
And, you know, you've got a prime minister who seems to be a bit at sea, so I don't know. I mean, and you can sort of say Hu Jintao was not exactly, was not a phenomenally charismatic and big leader in China. So I think this is rather more personal than, you know, generalisations of this sort or of a cultural kind can be really made, you know.
I accepted his proposition. I think it is true. I think China is a much more complex country than the United States for a variety of reasons.
I don't know about that either. It depends on how you define complexity. So.
Yeah, I suppose. Okay. All right. Well, look, we might talk about that another day, but I think we've covered this issue and I'm really grateful that you could make the time. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Professor Peter Rowe, he's Professor of Architecture and Urban Design at Harvard University.